Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and librarians about books, libraries, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. I'm very delighted to be sitting at the Library of Congress today and talking with Roberta Schaefer, Associate Librarian for Library Services at LC. She has held many distinguished and influential positions as a librarian and educator over the course of her career, including head of the Law Library here at the Library of Congress and dean of the School of Library Science at the University of Texas at Austin. She's going to talk with us today about this grand and august institution that she administers, as well as about the noble profession of librarianship and its place in our information society. Hello, Roberta.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for inviting me to be part of your show.
Well, thank you for having me here. It's a wonderful place. And just to start off, you know, this is a grand institution in many ways. First off, architecturally, it's overwhelmingly beautiful, especially the Jefferson Building. And there are other ways in which it's grand. Of course, it's a grand institution in terms of size, isn't it?
Well, it is, as you probably know, the largest library in the world, but that's not really where its claim to fame comes. It's really in the fact that it's universal in the knowledge it contains and tries to be comprehensive. But just for a second, let's sort of walk our radio audience through where we're sitting. So we're sitting in my office in the Madison Building on the sixth floor, and we are on the east side of the building. And I always like to tease the Librarian of Congress about that because in the morning when I come in, the sun is rising and I am where the sun rises. He is at the exact opposite end of this corridor, so he is west and he's where the sun sets. And I think that the architect played a joke on the Librarian of Congress by putting him or her, maybe in the future, on the west side of the building. But what we're looking out at is in our peripheral vision to our west, we see the United States Congress.
Yes.
And so we see the building, the Capitol building, in all of its grandeur. And that keeps me very, very focused on the fact that we are the Library of Congress. And because Congress is of the people of the United States, we really are the Library of America. And that's really important. And then my position, I look out on the extraordinary Jefferson Building and the wonderful Art Deco Adams Building. And I'm sitting in the Madison Building. So for all intents and purposes, I'm looking out on the collections and the people who manage them, except for our National Library for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, which is located a few miles from here, and then our extraordinary Packard Campus, where we are restoring, preserving, and allowing access to most of American and global broadcast television, movies from the beginning of the whole industry to the present day, and then recorded sound on the enormous amounts of media that sound has been recorded on. And so I see that. And then to the east, I have this beautiful vista of windows that looks out on Capitol Hill. And Capitol Hill is a neighborhood, in addition to being the seat of the Supreme Court, the Library of Congress, and the United States Capitol. Well, Capitol Hill happens to be a phenomenal neighborhood because very wealthy people live on Capitol Hill. At the same time, very poor people live on Capitol Hill. There are trade associations and banks that trade in the millions of dollars every day. But there are also mom-and-pop stores on Capitol Hill. And so that tells me that one of the most important things about the library is that it is open to everyone. It doesn't matter what your business here is. It doesn't matter what your economic level is. This is a library for you to access. And so in my case, while you're right, the Thomas Jefferson Building is extraordinary inside. It's inspiring. It's the whole story of how America envisioned herself becoming a world power at the turn of the 20th century. The building just tells you that the minute you walk in. But what my office reminds me every day is, what is the mission of the Library of Congress? It's to be mindful of the American people, to collect the materials that they need now and for generations to come, to do everything possible to preserve them and make them accessible so that they can serve the people who I see out of my window every day.
The fact that the Library of Congress is a library of the people has to do with the idea that the Founding Fathers had, that knowledge and information are essential for democracy, that people can't govern themselves if they haven't the information and the wherewithal to do it.
I think that that is true, but I think when they created the first Library of Congress as a law library,
yes,
was really that they wanted to have the materials at hand to be able to formulate the government, to really be able to implement this great idea that came out of the Revolution and out of the period of Enlightenment. So I think it started as a law library, but then when the opportunity came to purchase the Jefferson collection, then there was a realization that the country was growing and that we established our legal infrastructure, our legal system, and now there would be no topic that Congress wouldn't need to deliberate about, so that we needed to have a much broader scope of knowledge at our fingertips as legislators and as the American people than that first 1800 collection would have given us.
Yeah. And it was originally housed in the Capitol building itself, wasn't
it? Yes. Until this building was built, the Library of Congress was right in the Capitol. But, of course, this was way before 9/11 and security and all of that. And so, actually, people who lived in the city used the Library of Congress as kind of the public library.
Yeah.
And at a certain point in time, the law books were so popular that they pulled out the legal materials. This proved to be incredibly fabulous when we had our first fire here, because at least the law books were saved. That area did not burn. But, of course, it was terrible to have a fire in the Capitol that affected the library.
The library, it really does have an illustrious history, doesn't it? And it's had wonderful leadership over the years, especially
visionary.
In the 20th century.
Yes, well, visionary leadership. But really all throughout its life, it's been fortunate to have leaders who have anticipated the needs of the next generation and really built the collections to meet that need.
Yes, and you're looked upon by all the public libraries in the country, really, as the sort of mothership, mother of public libraries, in a sense, you know.
And we do a lot of acquisitions. I think it's a little known fact that we have 6 offices abroad, and these are in regions for which there isn't a mature information distribution system. And so we have our people on the ground who are able to go where knowledge is being produced and collect it directly. And in the process of doing that collection, we actually acquire on behalf of a number of academic and think tanks around the country.
The Library of Congress also, it's a very old department in the government, isn't it? It predates, as I understand it, the post office itself.
It's possible that it predates the post office. What I think what we do as our claim to fame is say that we're the oldest cultural institution. And there may be people who claim that the post office is a cultural institution because for many, many years, of course, that was how we got our knowledge, through the Postal Service. So it had a big role to play, but I think they're meaning more that we predate the Smithsonian.
And there was conflict in the 19th century, wasn't there, between the Smithsonian and the Library of Congress about which was going to be the National Library?
The Smithsonian and the Library sort of divvied up the appropriate materials from the Smithson Devise.
Yeah.
I would like to think, based on our current relationship with the Smithsonian, which is entirely friendly, entirely collaborative, that it has always been that way.
Yes.
But perhaps there might have been some push and pull about who would get the papers or the books and who would get the artifacts. But it seemed to all have worked out really well in the end. So let's hope that other entities, if they are in conflict, can take a lesson from the library and the Smithsonian.
And the National Archives, how do you divide up what goes into the Library of Congress and what goes into the National Archives? But the National Archives also is an immense institution with immense holdings.
Yes, and another collaborator. So I almost prefer to sort of not think of it as dividing up, but how do we share the cultural heritage of America and also the responsibility for collecting the creative and knowledge output of Americans? So we would be remiss if we just said that that was happening at the Smithsonian and at NARA and at the Library of Congress, because that's actually happening at the 2 other major national libraries, National Agriculture and National Library of Medicine, and then approximately 2,000 other federal libraries around the world that are collecting cultural heritage or information on behalf of the American people. Uh-huh. But dividing up with NARA is really not all that difficult because their mandate is quite specific. They're the record keeper.
Yes.
And so we don't compete with them. They're the experts on keeping America's business records.
Yeah.
And many, many times, particularly in the area of local history and genealogy, there's wonderful symbiosis between what we have and what they have. And we all like to say that that's one of the greatest things about technology, that now the person who's looking for the knowledge can absolutely go ahead and just merge what we have yes. among these 2,000 federal libraries instantaneously themselves at home. So that the taxpayer in Maryland and the taxpayer in Montana has equal access to the riches of America's intellectual output.
Yeah. And you are then digitizing all the time.
We're trying to. All of us are.
Yes, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
All of us are.
So just to give people an idea in terms of numbers and the size of your collections, can you give some
gosh,
figures?
Well, yes, everything yeah. is in the millions.
Yes.
Everything. I can't think yeah. of anything we collect, somebody will probably correct me,
yes.
that is not at least in the one-digit millions.
Mm-hmm.
So movies, manuscripts, prints and photographs, books, maps, gosh, musical scores, music.
Yeah.
Everything is in the one-digit at least millions, some in the two-digit millions. I can't think of anything yet, unless we're measuring bytes
mm-hmm.
and bits,
yeah.
that's in the three-digit millions,
yeah.
but we get so much every day that it's possible that we will tip that point any mm-hmm. day now
yeah.
in one of the special collections.
Yeah. And the Jefferson Building, we still have our reading room there, and it's still an operating reading room, unlike the British Library that,
right.
that closed
right.
their reading room. So can any citizen go into the Library of Congress and request a book in the reading room?
Well, actually, we have to correct you on that, Tom, because we actually have 21 reading rooms.
Oh, yes.
So they are right now divided either by format or subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, anyone can go into any one of our 21, except there are two prerequisites.
Mm-hmm.
The first is that unless there's a special reason with documentation, you must be 16 years old or older.
Yeah.
And the second is that you have to have a reader's card, which is free of charge, but you must have some kind of government-issued ID, not necessarily U.S.
Mm-hmm.
at all. And you get a reader's card based on that government-issued ID. And as long as you meet the age threshold and you can show our reader's card that you get at an office we have, you are free to come in and use the reading rooms.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, anybody is free to access our collections online through our website and ask a reference question online.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you do reference online.
We do chat as
yeah,
well.
Citizens all over the United States then.
And the world.
Yeah. And just to reiterate, the Library of Congress is a very American institution in the principles that it's based on, but as you say, it's also an international institution.
And it's interesting that you sort of identified that very American in terms of its values.
Yes.
And one of the most American things about it in terms of its values is that only 40% of its collections are in English. And that's the whole English-speaking world.
Mm-hmm.
And many people are very surprised to know that. Because they would imagine that 90%. But the reality is that America is very willing to look at other cultures and to learn from other cultures. That's a societal value that we have held in this country for a very long time, which I would argue, I mean, I know there have been some hiccups on this, but I would argue has been reflected in our openness to immigration
mm-hmm.
and to not having an official language of the nation and all of these things. So 40% of the collections, only 40%,
yeah.
are in English. The other 60%, depending on who you speak to on the Library of Congress staff, are either in 430 or 457 other languages, living and dead. But the differential is that some people disagree about dialects, and they count certain dialects as languages. So it's kind of amazing that we have this. And then we have a staff that is expert in helping people access materials in all the formats and languages that we collect.
So can you talk about the structure of the Library of Congress and the way it's organized? Because I imagine you have a lot to manage.
I have the biggest department with about 53 units, and I myself have a little over 1,500 people in my unit. Mm. So I'm the largest by far, yes, because the institution only has about, I think, 2,500 staff all totaled. But the other units that are my peers across the organization chart are the Congressional Research Service, which this year is celebrating its 100th birthday. And the CRS, as it is mostly known, does research and analysis, objective analysis, on behalf of the members of Congress, their staffs, and the congressional committees. The Copyright Office, since about 1860, is housed here in the Library of Congress, and that's another department. And, of course, as you know, they administer the U.S. copyright laws, and they also facilitate the library getting materials in as part of their registration and deposit requirements, so that they were placed here in the middle of the 19th century as a way to build the collections of the library. Very ingenious. 24.6% of our collections come in to the library through copyright. And so if we had to purchase that material, our budget would really be enormously bigger, and I don't think Congress would be too happy about a 24.6% increase in our budget. So we're very lucky, and we love having the Copyright Office here for many reasons. But the other office is the Law Library, where I had the pleasure of being the head as Law Librarian of Congress. And the Law Library is very interesting because it's really different from all of the others. It, by mandate or by statute, serves the foreign legal research needs of the U.S. Congress. Uh-huh. So that's the little piece that CRS does not do at all.
So it's an international law library.
It's global.
Yes, yeah.
It serves the executive and the judicial branches' need for foreign legal assistance.
So the State Department particularly.
State Department, Department of Justice, INS, Environmental Protection. Mm-hmm. Nobody today doing federal executive branch business, and I hope that doesn't sound oxymoronic, can really be operating in a silo of just U.S. law. Almost everything we do today has an impact or touches dealings with other countries' laws and treaties and conventions and things like that.
Yes.
So while we have federal agencies that are big clients of the law library, let's not forget the IRS, because that's huge.
Mm-hmm.
People looking for shelters and havens, yeah, and corporations having to pay taxes depending on their nationhood and citizenship. But everybody needs the law library. And then the law library is open to the public. And that's the most exciting thing. Everybody in the country has a law library at their disposal.
Do you miss the law library?
Every day.
Yes. Yes, yeah.
Especially on the bad days.
Yes. Well, since law librarianship is your specialty, how much does legal work involve research? People have an idea, you know, I watch Perry Mason, the reruns every night. You know, it's all about what goes on in the courtroom, but there's a lot that goes on in law libraries, isn't there?
Well, there's a lot that goes on in legal research.
Yes.
So I think years ago, I think the statistic was only 15% of American lawyers ever go into a courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
Most of what they're doing is transactional work.
Yes.
They are representing people who are working on family documents, setting up businesses, partnerships, inheritance, trusts, estates, wills, probate, just transactions. You want to buy X and I want to sell Y, and so we have to have contractual relations. And so that's a huge part of the practice of law, and therefore the kinds of questions that the law library gets.
Yes.
And of course, there's the whole area of criminal law.
Was there a difference in the kind of practice you did working for law firms as opposed to working in the law library for the government?
Yes. Well, a law firm law librarian does do legal research,
yes,
for sure.
Yeah.
But where you serve the most critical role in a law firm setting is that you are the knowledge person of other disciplines, so that if lawyers need information on chemicals in an environmental area or a food and drug area, if somebody wants to make a literary allusion in an oral argument, if somebody is looking at what the weather was on a particular day when an accident might have happened, they will turn to the law firm library staff to provide the law-related information. In the Law Library of Congress, it's the law library that's providing the legal information. So it's quite a difference in portfolio between the two sectors.
Interesting. Can you talk a bit about the services the Library of Congress offers, just sort of generally?
Well, we try to really serve everybody through their entire life.
This is about lifelong learning.
Lifelong learning, and of course, lifelong learning for us starts with that incredible life skill, the ability to read.
Yes.
And so we have a number of projects that are focused on making sure that people have the ability to read and have reading comprehension. And that starts with our Young Reader Center in the Jefferson Building and our phenomenal annual event, the National Book Festival, which has a huge aspect of it dedicated to very young readers and young adult readers. But we really try to do things that will keep people reading. In the United States today, and in many first and even second world countries, people have so many demands on their time that they become what is called illiterate, where you have the ability to read, but you don't use that skill. And over time, if that skill is not used, then you do not continue to grow your vocabulary, you do not continue to understand other points of view, grow other ways of thinking and learning. And so we feel that illiteracy is a critical crisis that we have a definite role in fighting.
Mm-hmm.
But we also try to do things at the library that will continue people's interest in reading and expanding their mind, not just through film and going to rock concerts and things like that, which are all valid ways of looking at the universe.
Yes.
But to continue reading, that's a critical part of what we think of as our mission to America.
Mm-hmm. So you have programs to, cultivate.
Yes, to cultivate that, to inspire reading. We feel that it will not do our country a lot of good if people don't reach out and read something that may be antithetical to their political point of view, or if we don't help people understand another culture or another form of music, another genre of music. So we try to have a portfolio here that will enable someone very easily to reach out to something different, out of their comfort zone or just out of their knowledge zone. If we tend to allow ourselves to be in our own little world, in our own little capsule or our own little nest, it's probably fair to say that it's the library's point of view that that doesn't help build good citizenship.
True. It's about reaching out and
and expanding and constantly learning and learning something new and different
from others. So we often have undergraduates at your alma mater at Vassar who decide to go on to librarianship. They'll often work with library staff, and we can get to know them sometimes. And I wonder if you could talk about your career a bit. Did you graduate from Vassar intending to become a librarian?
Oh, well, that's a very good question, and I will say that I think you're right, that Vassar and librarianship share a lot in that, as you know, Vassar was one of the first colleges worldwide that embraced the theory that undergraduates should look at primary sources.
Yes. Yeah.
And so the library has that concept in mind, that we're wanting people to look at primary sources, at the artifact, not the interpreted artifact.
Yeah.
And so I've often thought back that Vassar is a perfect feeder for library science because that very basic philosophy, that very 1863 philosophy, still pervades the college and the teaching methodology that's used.
Yeah, it does, very much so.
Yeah.
We actually don't buy very actively criticism, literary criticism.
Yes.
We buy primary texts.
Exactly.
And of course, we have the Loeb Center.
Right.
And the founding collection of works of art was part of the gift of books and paintings that the college was sort of based on for that very reason.
Yeah. And so I think that's a natural affinity. But I think I was graduating from college at a time when women were really challenged to seek professional lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I really did not know what I wanted to do, But I knew that I loved writing and I loved research.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I knew that actually before coming to Vassar, but that was one of the reasons that it was easy to choose Vassar, because the curriculum and the then required courses had a lot of research and writing in them from the get-go, from freshman year.
Yeah.
And so that made Vassar a very attractive undergraduate school for me. I also knew, for me, that there would be plenty of time to go to a university. I came from a almost exclusively Cornell family, and I spent a summer in high school at Cornell on the National Science Foundation high school program. And I know, and my parents would never admit this, that the whole basis behind that was to get me indoctrinated, you know, just follow my sister, follow my parents, follow my maternal grandmother to Ithaca.
Mm-hmm.
But when I went to interview at Cornell, it just seemed so large for me and so overwhelming. And I couldn't imagine if I had thought about an urban huge university.
Yes, Columbia,
that would have, a Columbia or a Yale, you know, is right in the city.
Yes.
So I really think that Vassar was the perfect choice for me. But I wanted to find a profession where I would use research and writing.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was at Vassar, I took a fair number of courses having to do with jurisprudence and law.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought that I would go to law school, never with the idea of practicing law, but just understanding that law really mobilized the two things I love to do,
research
and
writing. Yeah.
So I looked upon it very much as an academic decision.
Yes.
And then while I was in law school, I really came to realize that the thing I loved even more than the writing was the research.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for an enormously inspiring law professor who was a phenomenal researcher. And in the course of working for him, he sent me to Washington for a summer. He had a grant.
Mm-hmm.
And there was money for me to come for 3 weeks to the Library of Congress, where I had only been on a high school trip when I was about 14.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only time I'd ever been here at the Library of Congress. And I came to the Library of Congress, and I was here. And at that time, the law library was in the Jefferson Building. And I just fell in love with the whole building and the atmosphere. And I said to myself, someday I'm going to work at the Library of Congress. And I think that it's fine for people to sort of not have a career goal. I think you can definitely have a rich professional life by being opportunistic. But I set a goal for myself to just work here at some point. And not too long after I finished my law school and library degree, and the library degree came as a requirement to being a researcher, I got a job here as the special assistant, the first special assistant to the then law librarian of Congress, Carlton Waller Kenyon.
Mm-hmm.
And while working for Mr. Kenyon, I set for myself the goal of someday becoming the law librarian of Congress.
Uh-huh.
And from that moment on, and I think I was about 27 or 28 years old, every job I took and every opportunity I pursued, I put up against a litmus test of how will this prepare me to be the law librarian of Congress.
Hmm.
And that's what happened. So it was my dream job.
Yeah.
But I don't say that that's for everyone.
I think,
you know, it worked very well for President Clinton, and it worked for me. But I think one can be very enriched by being opportunistic.
Yes, most people, yours truly, just wash up in places, you know, which isn't bad.
No, I mean,
it's
happy.
It's life. Yes,
yeah,
it is. Yeah. So,
but that was not my case. So,
so
I would say to people, the other thing I will say, I would like to say one other thing about librarianship.
Mm-hmm.
When I finished my library degree, I became almost fanatical about an impossible scenario, which is as follows. Nobody should be allowed to go to college until they have completed a master's in library science. Because when I got out of library school, after I took a boatload of reference courses, humanities reference, social science, science, statistics, and research methodologies, all that stuff that people take or took in library school, I realized all the opportunities I had missed to learn things when I was in high school and college.
Yeah.
And I said, nobody should be allowed the privilege of higher education until they understand the research materials that they can tap to learn. And of course, as I say, it's a ridiculous scenario, but I still sort of think it in my head.
Well, I had myself, it was just a half credit course when I was a freshman in college. And because of that, you know, that was enough for me to know that every course I took after that, I knew how to do research for that course. The tools in those years weren't as complex as they are now, so it would take more time, I think, now than just a half credit. But I feel the same way, that all students starting out should get some kind of training. The argument against it is it's sort of instrumentalist. It's not about the life of the mind, but you need that kind of training. And all the studies show that students, when they're given research assignments, you know, they understand lectures and they understand taking tests and they understand that side of higher education, undergraduates, but they don't understand research. And then they're given assignments and they show up in the library. And I compare it to teaching someone to swim by throwing them off the end of the dock and just walking away. You know, they're mm-hmm. supposed to know how to do it without any training.
Right.
So it falls on the librarians to sort of pick up the slack, but it's very piecemeal. You know, there's nothing systematic about it for most of us. It's becoming, there are strategies being developed about bringing library training into course planning for freshmen.
And of course, in law school, that's been the trend for many, many years, that the librarians come into the classroom after the students have had the first year class mm-hmm. and teach them the methodology for tax research or statutory research or things like that. But I think, Tom, that you make an excellent point, which sort of punctuates my conviction, and that simply is that a lot of people could go through undergraduate school getting knowledge prepackaged mm-hmm. for them. The lecture is prepackaged.
Yes.
The test sets the package.
Yes, yes.
But when you give a student a research assignment, you don't say, this is the path, this is the package, here it is, open it up. You say, okay, there's no map, just go in there.
Yes.
And that way of really self-discovery, so it yeah. frames the life of the mind yes, yeah. so much more richly than yeah. a packaged experience.
Yeah. So there's a lot to being a librarian, and there's a lot of responsibility on our shoulders if you think about it collectively. We're not only responsible for deciding what gets remembered in the civilization, which is no small thing, but how this knowledge is organized, how it's preserved, and how it's disseminated. And with respect to dissemination, we're therefore responsible to our communities for providing them with the material for education, to some extent the tools of education. David Lankus, mm-hmm. who teaches at Syracuse, referred to librarians, when we're doing what we should be doing, as radical agents of positive change. And he meant by that not that we apply technology so much in a radical way, but that we facilitate education in our communities, the acquisition mm-hmm. of knowledge, and that education is radical in a sense. It has to do with change. So, you know, we're talking about a wide range of skill sets here. You know, we have to know about knowledge and how it's organized. We have to know about markets and the economics of publishing. We have to know about learning and education and, you know, right. how the mind actually acquires information. And we also have to know, I think, about advocacy and the politics of information. And having directed a library program yourself, I wonder, do you think library schools are doing a good job at preparing people to be both custodians of knowledge and community educators? Because it's a lot to have to train someone for.
I personally do. I know mm-hmm. that a lot of employers in lots of other professions, particularly my other profession, law, you know, pull out their hair, that people come out of law school and they can't practice law. But I think that library schools actually do an excellent job of preparing students for the marketplace, mm-hmm. but also in imbuing them with the value system of being the knowledge stewards of society. And I think it's just more and more challenging today because, in my day anyway, information really only came in maybe five different formats. You know, there were maps, there were manuscripts, there were books,
yes.
there were films, maybe. If I'm not going to be making myself seem too old, there were film strips in those days.
Yes, I was just talking to someone about those, yes. Yeah.
There were slides if you were doing art. But the formats were really limited. Today, you have to look at all those formats. They're still around. And then you have to look at social media. And we have to look at big data. Mm-hmm. And we have to look at big data in ways that are very unstructured. We have to look at how do we marry up book material with what's coming off the metro or the freeway in terms of how many cars pass this exit every day, and how does that then help us do urban planning? So I think what's happening today is that the library schools can only do so much, but that, like every profession, we have an immense responsibility, if not burden, to constantly be self-educating.
Yes.
And that we cannot rest on a degree that we got even a year ago. And so it's very hard to have a life, practice a profession, and continue to refresh that river of knowledge that you are expected to have. And the library schools can't really do more than they're doing.
Yeah, can't keep up. So does the Library of Congress have a professional development program for your own staff or for people outside of the Library of Congress?
Well, we have a lot more formal programs for people outside of the library than we do inside.
For your own staff.
And that's, I think, often the case at a national library. Yeah. But we have a phenomenal program in preservation sciences that reaches an international audience. And we have a huge program in training related to our bibliographic systems. So we've always been terrific at MARC education, now at RDA. Yeah. As we're rolling out this brand new MARC replacement bib frame, we have enormous outreach to everybody to explain our belief about what it takes to have a semantic organization of knowledge. Internally, we really depend much more on informal systems of mentoring each other and of just sort of learning on the job.
Yes.
We're not quite as good at formalizing our internal knowledge university.
We're, to some extent, like the medical profession, in that there are certainly conferences, et cetera, formal ways for keeping up, but there's so much mentoring that goes on, informal training. And for me, to become a librarian, it wouldn't have been enough just to get a library degree. I had to work in a library and be mentored by librarians to really understand how to apply what I was learning. So,
and I think that that's, you've made a very interesting point, and I think that like medical education, which has today a very heavy clinical component from the day they walk into medical school. Librarianship and the training needs to have that high clinical component.
Yeah.
When I was at the University of Texas at Austin, I used to tell the director of the library, "You are my hospital. You're the hospital for my students. This is where they will learn." And it's really important because for many of them, particularly in library schools, that will be their last opportunity to be at a very large, very comprehensive Research One university. They'll go out and they may work in a small town or at a specialized library or at a smaller academic library.
Yeah.
And so to sort of start at the place that's really a pinnacle is much better than sort of having very parochial exposure and then having to sort of scale that up.
Yeah.
So I think that library schools really need to invest a lot more in their relationship with their libraries on their campus.
Yes. Finally, this is very much a utopian institution, it seems to me. It's founded on a lofty idea of the human being as a rational citizen. It's about empowerment through reason and information, and it's about the common good, about sharing and communication being at the heart of what makes us who we are. And all public libraries have this feeling about them to me. You know, there's a sort of excitement about them. And I do believe everyone changes a bit by just walking into the space of a public library. And I remember when I got my first library card, it was the first time I ever really felt like a citizen and equal to other people. But in this place, the Library of Congress, this sensibility is almost overwhelming. So I wonder, do you feel this when you come to work every morning, this sense of exhilaration, even with all your responsibilities and whatever downsides there are to managing so complex and extensive an organization, including, I'm sure, long hours?
Yes, this kind of a job overtakes your life.
Yes.
So, you know, there are no boundaries between work and life.
Yeah.
Everything is work. Yes, you do. In fact, it's even not only just knowing the mission, but actually, as we started our conversation, walking through the Jefferson Building, because that building in its architecture and in its art so much reflects all the good values of America, all the hopefulness of a people coming together to have economic and intellectual viability across the population. And so it's sort of the embodiment of the democratization of knowledge.
Yes.
And I find I walk through the Jefferson Building, I would say, probably at least once a day, and I still get teary-eyed. And when I'm having a bad day, I will often go to one of our specialized collections and just ask the curators if I could see, you know, a Galileo notebook or a Martin Ramirez drawing or a phenomenal map, even a map that may just be insurance maps from the turn of the 20th century. But to really understand that this institution has an enormous responsibility, not only to America, but to American values for everyone else.
Yes.
And, you know, we, in recent times, the ugly American idea has, you know, we become uglier and uglier to lots of people around the world. But if they could understand us from the lens of the Library of Congress, I think it would do a lot for our ability to sort of influence in a positive way and have moral authority in the most positive, not judgmental way. If they could see that their history and their thoughts and the thoughts of those people who are their icons in their cultures are here in America, I think it would make an enormous difference in how they think about us. And so we think about that, those of us, everybody who works here, from the shelver to the Librarian of Congress, thinks about that. One time, a very young bookshelver in the law library said something to me which is totally true. He said, "I take my job so seriously. There are so many books here that if I misshelve this book, even by 3 or 4 books over, I could deny generations of people access to it. And so what I'm doing is so important." And I think everybody across the institution feels that. And we have great intellectual debates. I just came out of a huge debate with our staff and our union. I feel that if it was a war, I lost the war.
Yeah.
I feel bad about it because I still feel I'm very right in what I was trying to do. But nonetheless, you did get to see in that debate the passion, the different points of view, but by the same token, the shared value that what we want to do is best for the library. And that we also, which I think is a little bit different than anywhere else I've ever worked, we also have a very, very strong responsibility to the future. So we think in terms of what we do affecting 100 years from now. And that's because we are the wonderful beneficiaries of people who 100 years ago obviously thought about the legacy they were leaving us. I have no doubt that the people in 1914 and in 1814 were thinking of me, because every day when I go to the shelf and I need something, and it was acquired in 1914, and I think to myself, how did they know in 2014 I was going to need this? I hope I have that magic in my fingertips to be able to leave that kind of legacy.
Librarians don't count in years, you know, we count in decades and really centuries.
Generations.
Like architects.
So, yes, we do.
So I want to thank you, Roberta, for inviting me into your office to talk about the Library of Congress and the career of librarianship.
Well, thank you, Tom, for reaching out to me. I know you're here for a conference, and
yes, the art libraries conference.
Right, the art libraries, and I hope it'll be a wonderful conference, and I'm delighted to know that someone of your caliber is minding the store at my alma mater.
Thank you, minding the art library. We've been talking with Roberta Schaefer here at the Library of Congress about the library and its role in today's information-intense world. You've been listening to the Library Cafe on WVKR Independent Radio 91.3 FM Poughkeepsie. I'm Thomas Hill. Thanks for tuning in.